Hi everyone, welcome to another of our ILS Asia virtual event broadcasts. Please do go to the event website to see the details of our kind sponsors, without who we couldn't put on this event, and also you can view the agenda and access all of the on-demand videos from the conference so far there, and everything else will be archived for your viewing pleasure. So we're continuing to update you on ILS activity and opportunities across the Asia region with a focus on expanding market access and opportunities. But it's important to also consider some of the issues that matter on the management side of ILS investing. And so for this live panel discussion, I'm delighted to be joined by some experts who can help to shed some light on some of this. So we're going to cover some of the key investment management issues related to insurance-linked securities. And joining me today, I have Lorenzo Volpi, partner at Leadenhall Capital Partners, Martin Burke, CFO at Mount Logan Re, and Donna Davis, associate consultant at Frontier Advisors. So thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
So for this session, we're going to take a bit of a rapid-fire trip through a range of ILS investment management issues that matter in 2021, as well as also some discussion later on about investor trends being seen in the Asia-Pacific region. So to the people watching, do remember that you can ask questions as the panel progresses using the box on the screen in front of you, and we'll try to get to some of them towards the end of the hour. So the first issue I wanted to discuss really is the pandemic, because COVID has impacted everyone and it's really something we cannot ignore still. So I thought I'd turn to you first, Lorenzo. So now things are getting a little easier, but I assume most of your investor meetings remain virtual. How do you feel the industry's adapted to this new normal? Do you feel it's getting easier to manage now that we're almost a year and a half way into this new way of doing business?
Yes, Steve. Now, it's obviously easier to manage because, as you said, we are used to it. I must say that it still remains a relationship business, what we do. And I'd really love to think that we'll be able to soon travel and meet investors face-to-face. Now, we've been now doing this for slightly more than a year. And one of the advantages that we have as Leadenhall is that we've been around now for, since 2008. So, at the time we used to travel a lot. We met a lot of investors around the world. So we already established a number of relationships. We have over $6.3 billion of assets under management. So that also obviously has helped in terms of, the fact that as you already know people, then it's not difficult to arrange a webinar or a WebEx. Obviously, assuming they have time to do it. I must say sometimes I do notice a bit of fatigue, people that, because you also tend to do many more than, when you travel, you also spend a lot of time on the road, whereas when you're stuck in the office or at home and you do a lot of these WebEx, you also need to plan it properly. And sometimes also I think investors, get tired about it. I think everyone, would probably agree that it would be nice finally to meet in person. Also, as I said, we really value the relationship that we build with investors. So, and also you need to build a new relationship. So it's not just existing investors, but also prospective investors. And so if you need to build new relationships, then I think it's quite hard to get, it does happen, but it's quite hard to get the new money from investors that have not met you face to face so far. So, hopefully we'll be back to normal soon, even if we see that now there is a, the variant and the new variant again. And this, I think we'll have to live with this virus for a while.
Yeah, I mean, we're all hoping that we can get back to travel and conferences and things like that as well. Martin, turning to you, you're based in Bermuda, and obviously the government there appears to have handled the pandemic pretty well. Your parent company, Everest Re, has ambitions to expand the Mount Logan Re asset base, but is the ongoing situation making that more challenging, do you think?
Hi, Steve, and thanks again for having us on. Yes, I'd say that we're very fortunate here in Bermuda that the government has done a great job in initially the restrictions, but also now in kind of getting the population kind of fully vaccinated, our large majority. So, to be able to do this from the office is great. We feel fortunate, and it feels a little bit more back to normal on the island, even if not so back home and in various places. I'd agree. I agree with Lorenzo's comments. I think you know, on the margin, the pandemic is still having a, you know, an impact, specifically on certain investors from whichever regions they are and how they're impacted by the virus. You know, but however, we still feel very bullish in terms of growing our overall AUM with, you know, Everest's kind of ambitions. And I think just several factors in terms of, you know, the asset class's attractive kind of risk-adjusted returns given the rate, the recent 4 years of rate increases. You know, the pandemic also, again, proved the kind of non-correlation benefit last year in March when the markets were down. And then the recent years of cat losses have been an opportunity for managers to kind of show, you know, kind of their relative performance versus their peers. So overall, I think while it is on the margin, still impacting, especially kind of new investors, when you don't have the chance to have those face-to-face meetings, we remain bullish that, you know, over the medium term, a kind of growing AUM, and hopefully, you know, the pandemic eventually is a thing of the past.
Mm. Yeah, you make a good point there, Martin, as well, that the investment case is actually pretty strong right now, and the evidence of sort of last March, April, when ILS was a very robust asset class for investors, as surely that's going to play into generating further inflows for people in the long term, you would think. Moving on to Donna. Now, so you work as a investment consultant and obviously work very closely with large institutional investors as they explore the ILS asset class. How are end investors coping with the lack of travel, the issues around that and uncertainty? And Lorenzo mentioned the challenges with getting new investors into the asset class. Is this something that you see from your vantage point?
Yeah, thanks, Steve, and thanks for having us as part of the panel today. Yeah, definitely reiterate the points that Lorenzo and Martin made. I think it makes it challenging, and you're having to find new ways to do due diligence. I think the, you know, face-to-face and digging into a product and getting to meet the team is different. But on the flip side, it's actually been quite interesting. It's almost more intimate the way you're connecting with different managers and getting to know them. You're literally stepping into their homes. You know, sometimes there's children or pets or postmen on the phone. So I think it's a strange dichotomy. But I would actually reiterate Lorenzo's point. I actually think we've had more connection, and our investors have said the same thing. They felt more connected because sometimes with Zoom, it's easier to organise a conference or a connection with people. And so I think that's actually benefited a lot of the investors. So yeah, I think we're feeling better informed.
Good, good. And so sticking with you, Donna, let's move on and talk about the performance of the ILS asset class, which is the other factor obviously investors are looking closely at. So after a few years with some difficult losses, 2021 began with the US winter storms, and at the same time we've got rising reinsurance rates, and so return potentially is rising in the ILS portfolios. Now, you track the performance potential of a group of ILS funds. How are they looking from Frontier's point of view at this stage of 2021?
Yeah, so it's been an interesting year, I think, or an interesting couple of years to monitor the performance. What we do here at Frontier is we actually categorise the subsectors by our expected loss and then monitor their forward-looking characteristics. And it gives us a really interesting perspective on the market. So I think, like everyone has seen, sort of no loss yields weren't at the levels people were expecting. I think there was a lot of capital that came in, and so at renewals, you know, top level pricing wasn't at levels we had expected. But what was really interesting was a lot of renegotiation at terms and conditions really seemed to filter through to kind of your expected loss, like reductions in expected loss and tails. And so we're finding risk adjusted returns are actually looking a lot better. I think, you know, as everyone's noticed, cat bonds are continuing to outperform private ILS, and, you know, per occurrence outperforming aggregate. And I think private ILS did struggle a little bit in Q1, but what we're finding in Q2 is actual losses are rolling through. Some of the loss estimates that had been forecast are coming in actually lower. So there's some nice positive marks in private ILS. So we're actually seeing them recover a little bit better. So it's been interesting seeing the two asset class interplay.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. So over the longer term, we could see private ILS catching up with the pure cat bond funds, you think?
Yeah, so it's looking a little bit like that in Q2, but I mean, we're just heading into hurricane season, so it's always one of those kind of wait and see moments, but it's been interesting watching that interplay.
Absolutely. And Q2 has been a little bit more benign in terms of loss activity as well, which has been positive for the sector. Lorenzo, moving to you now. Leadenhall invests broadly across the ILS market. You have cap on funds, you focus on private ILS and collateralized reinsurance, and also life insurance and securities as well. So for the investors watching, how do you see the market dynamic for each of those segments right now?
Yeah, with regard to no life, I echo Donna's comments. I think the overall market remain attractive. I mean, actually, it's quite interesting that if you look at historically post 2017 events, we had a great reload of investors' money, which was extremely quick. I remember having to close our funds at one point, even before 1st of January, because we couldn't really absorb all the money. And today, the market conditions are better than they were just post 2017. But we don't see the same vibe that we used to see post 17. And obviously, for the reasons which we discussed in terms of loss creep associated to Irma and 2018 as well, which was a negative year for the industry. Having said that, when you look at the private market, as you made the point between carbons and private markets, the renewals on a risk-adjusted basis, as Donna said, was pretty good. Tightening of terms and conditions, the average premium increase was around 5 to 10%. Obviously, different behavior depending on whether we look at U.S. Primary reinsurance, where the loss-affected business, saw a premium increase of 10 to 40%. If it was no loss-affected, between 2.5 and 10%. The non-U.S. Primary reinsurance was loss-affected around 5 to 15. The no loss-affected was up to 7.5. And then there was a lot of discussions about retro, and we've seen premiums going up to around 10%. I mean, again, depending on different counterparties. So overall, the most important point I think for investors to appreciate is that these latest increases on a risk-adjusted basis are obviously compounding, right, on previous years. And this has been a trend that started in 2017. So historically, we are still in a very, I think, in an attractive situation. Obviously, the question now is whether we have reached the peak or not. But we'll see it, through the renewals in general. Our expectation is to the trend to continue. Just as a reminder, most of these private deals roll over, have a one-year tenor and roll over the same date. So obviously the premium increases that we saw for 1st of June relate to contracts that incepted 1st of June last year. For the 1st of January, we will see hopefully the same result given that they incepted 1st of January this year. If then we look at the carbon market, is usually easier for investors to keep an eye on because all the data, or at least the index, is publicly available, and there is a lot of coverage also from you, Steve, in terms of new issuances and so on. And we've seen that the first half of this year has been a record in terms of new issuances. And again, the premium in our market is always dependent on supply and demand of capital. So it really helps when you have either increased insurance penetration for the private market or new issuances for the carbon market, because it obviously means more demand for capital. And in the first half of this year, has been a record in terms of new issuances, $8.5 billion of new issuances versus $6.5 billion last year, of which, May with $2.6 billion was the highest month, and indemnity type of trigger were around 75%. And this also had an impact on the trading of the carbons. And in fact, May was the most active trading month, a bit of rebalancing from investors, either to, basically provide space for new bonds or to actually switch to some of the private placements if they have like investment funds that can mix the two. And we saw, trading around 82 bonds in May, with around, again, these are all estimates, 130, 120 trades in June, 116, 120 trades with 68 different bonds. So quite an active market. And of course, spreads, you know, on the primary tighten a bit, but multiples remain still attractive. For the year on average, we've seen multiple of premiums to expected loss of around 2.8, 2.9. In June, we saw that the primary bonds, you know, basically closed more at around 2.5, 2.6, but still historically very attractive. On the life side, I mean, we are, you know, being very successful. There is demand. The pandemic has not really affected it. It's still seen as a strong diversifier. And we're actually, you know, out there launching a new fund. And in Asia, actually, we see demand, which is important. And so I think overall, you know, for diversifiers, there should also always be space in an investor portfolio.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting that you note there that we're in a sort of similar situation to after 2017 in terms of rates being more attractive, but we're not seeing such large inflows. Do you think is that discipline from the sector, or is that just investors being a little slower this time?
I think, you know, it's an interesting question. I think it's, you know, I'm a strong believer that if you meet people in person, it's always easier to grab their attention and to make ILS a priority. And I think the COVID hasn't helped, but the COVID hasn't helped also because it's distracted investors and focused them on other asset classes. Then, of course, we always compete with other asset classes as well, you know, like real assets, for example, that as grabbing a lot of the attention. I think investors, you know, maybe in the past were looking at adding more to their portfolio, and now they are maybe concentrating slightly more sometimes and say less managers or less asset classes, but more due diligence and more reviews. Maybe that could be a reason. Obviously, you know, the 2018 didn't help, or 17. It was a sudden wake-up call for a number of investors thinking, okay, actually, there is risk here. I remember until 2017 meeting pension funds trustees and reminding them, you know, everyone extremely pleased with the asset class, reminding them, well, this is not a free lunch. Sooner or later, something will happen. But and that's why I think transparency and communication is really the key these days, right? I mean, the more you talk to investors, the more you explain, and, you know, the happier everyone should be, and the easier it should be for investors also to appreciate the value of the asset class. You know, we still need to remind them that this is a long-term play, you know, irrespective of everyone keeping looking at the, you know, the 1 year or the 2 year, you should think about this asset class as a long-term part of your portfolio.
Great, that's helpful. Thank you, Lorenzo. So staying on performance, Martin, let's turn to you. So at Mount Logan Re, you invest alongside your parent Everest Re and also on your own. But where are you seeing the most attractive opportunities in the current firming market environment? And do you feel this is going to last a while longer?
Sure, yeah. And Everest Re kind of as a large kind of global P&C insurer has, you know, has the benefit of really seeing the whole market. So Everest, we have like offices around the world and we've seedings from more than 100 countries. And what this allows is Everest to kind of dynamically allocate capital, you know, to where they see the best opportunities. And as you mentioned, Steve, then Mount Logan Investors, we kind of participate side by side. So we access all our business, you know, through Everest Re. Currently, we're seeing attractive opportunities in, you know, property, excess of loss, and FAC, property cat, casualty, especially on the facultative side, aviation, and mortgage. And the majority of the Mount Logan AUM really supports the property cat. And I'd echo Lorenzo and Donna's comments. You know, we've had 4 years of, you know, both rate and term improvement on the property cat space. And I think what we're seeing now is, so risk-adjusted returns are up, and we're seeing with recent performance, you know, more capital coming into the cat bond space. So we are seeing pressure when you look at the prices on cat bonds, which is probably coming off a little bit at the moment. And we're seeing most of the continued rate increases kind of on the private side, and especially probably, you know, more lower down in the working layers. But it's really that kind of opportunity to kind of dynamically allocate capital, you know, kind of deal by deal around the world, is kind of how we think about building the kind of the best risk-adjusted book. And then to your question, in terms of how long we think it will last, it does look, feel like it's leveling off a little bit. These recent renewals on the property cat side, but you know, the impact of COVID hasn't gone away. The impact of climate change is still with us. And I think the reinsurance market, you know, there's a, it feels like they're holding their line. So it'll be more, I think it's more a case of, it seems like maybe it's beginning to level off, but we don't really see it reducing in the near term.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you mentioned terms and conditions there. Obviously, that's something that we don't really see immediately in the pricing that gets reported out of renewals. That's something that will only prove out over time from portfolios. Do you think the kind of the return potential is better even absent the pricing increases now?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'll see that, you know, after loss events, when, you know, going back several years, when we looked at some of the Florida transactions and cascading covers, you know, sometimes when you have an event, it's hard to see some of the full impact of kind of tighter terms. If it's hours clauses or, you know, different individual terms in the contract that kind of are to the benefit of the reinsurer and the ILS investor. And I think the larger sophisticated investors, you know, really do appreciate where the market is. And while we haven't seen huge net inflows, I think some of that is, you know, might be covering over that a lot of investors who've been in the space a while are increasing their allocations, but we're still seeing a little bit of the exit, I think, in the industry from some of the smaller offices of people who maybe didn't fully understand the investment they were investing in. So I think, you know, I think within the kind of net marginal increases, there is definitely, we definitely have investors who are looking to allocate more. They've kind of stayed in through the cycle and are looking to increase their allocations at this time.
Well, that's positive, because that hopefully turns into the longer term investors that Sir Lorenzo was referring to as well. So one of the challenges over the last few years has been loss amplification caused by claim inflation and loss creep. And everyone's aware of some of the surprises that we've seen in reinsurance and ILS. And manager practices have been adjusted to try and deal with this. And we also have, obviously, legislation that may help in Florida. We won't really find out till the next major loss event, I suppose. But this year, we also have, and it's been widely reported, sort of inflationary factors on prices and reconstruction costs and things. So I felt the loss creep overall is something worth discussing, because it really could be a factor in any events that happen this year. Martin, Mount Logan Re, do you price with those uncertainties in mind? And what else have you learned from the last few years to try and reduce the risk of surprises for investors?
Yes, in regards to pricing, from Everest Re, who's really, you know, outpricing the deals on behalf of Mount Logan, I mean, this is really what they do day to day. So, you know, Everest Re's been around for 50 years. And there's more than 200 kind of dedicated staff to kind of underwriting risk management on the portfolio. So absolutely, see, that's something that they think deal by deal, you know, geography per risk. In terms of reducing the investor surprises, I really think about that in two ways. I think it's more about, it's kind of like, one, you kind of have to have robust processes in place, and then it's how you communicate to your investors. And on the process side, it really becomes, it's really down to, when there is an event, you know, how robust is your loss reserving process? And it's a simple, you know, there is a kind of a, the more robust your loss reserving process is, you know, the more work, the more experience you have about getting your initial estimate right, you know, you're just going to have a lower likelihood of having loss creep. And the second item then is how you communicate that to your investors. So soon after the event, you know, you're out talking to your investors and explaining what went into produce your estimate. When we talk to our investors, even in our separately managed accounts, you know, we show them analysis to look at. Well, if they're in a commingled account and we'd side pocketed, you know, what would be their impact on their loss? You're also educating them on kind of that range of uncertainty around the loss. And then ongoing, what we found is very helpful is just the more detailed reporting you can provide to your investors, you know, the more educated and understanding they are of the process, and the more they can also then educate their kind of end stakeholders. So each quarter, we provide an investment report to our investors that would show, you know, all the losses for the last, you know, several accident years by event. We show, like, you know, how much is paid by each cedent, how much is reported by each cedent, So it's at a very granular level. And then you can talk around these kind of performance reports with the investors. And again, that, you know, not only educates the investors, which helps with their, you know, queries from their end stakeholders, but really does eliminate kind of any, you know, surprise. They're kind of seeing each individual event and getting your view, which ones still have some valuation uncertainty, which ones are relatively mature and, you know, are pretty much fully reported.
Thank you, Martin. Maybe Steve,
sure. A point I would add to the description that Martin made, I think, is that, you know, it's pretty clear to us as an industry of what is required in terms of communication and transparency for all the existing investors, right? However, one thing that I think it's very important that we try hard to do is also to inform prospective investors about these risks to avoid, you know, the negative impact in after event. So I think one of the, and I see that by talking to different investors, you know, it's pretty common to cross investors that now have multiple ILS managers, right? And we all try to do our best in terms of communicate the risks and how, you know, the losses could impact the portfolio and collateral trapping and the use of side pockets. But one thing that I've, you know, should be done by all of us is also when we pitch to new investors to immediately bring up these questions. You know, I always say, write this down. Even if it sounds negative, it's better if we deal with it today because we haven't invested any money yet. And then if and when there is an event, my job becomes much easier because, you know, I won't get the question from the investor saying, oh, hang on a second, I didn't expect this to happen. You know, I didn't expect that it could take 2 or 3 years for my money to be released. Now, obviously, as a manager, we have now developed techniques, structuring techniques to mitigate all these risks anyway. But it's probably very important to teach them or explain them to investors at the very beginning of our pitching process rather than just thinking, you know, post that we're going to share as much as possible.
That's a very good point, actually, Lorenzo, because I could, thinking back sort of 10, 15 years, some of the sort of presentations I've seen over that sort of time very rarely really discussed side pockets or what they might mean to investors. And these were initial marketing documents. And as you said, obviously, the processes have now changed. So the managers are managing the impacts of events perhaps in a different way as well. Do you educate your investors as you go, as something new is put into your underwriting or portfolio strategy? Do you make sure everybody understands it at that time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I echo what Martin said in terms of, you know, what we should do. I mean, like we follow similar process. I think probably most of the ILS managers today need to provide a very detailed reporting on, you know, portfolios, losses, potential creeps, reserves. How do you estimate your reserves? You know, which type of buffers do you apply? Why you have this type of buffer? You know, what type of data are you looking at historically to justify this percentage on top of the reserves? But, you know, one thing I've always done since the very beginning is first meeting, side pockets, collateral trapping. I mean, always say, write it down. And they always look at me like, okay, what is that? Say, just write it down. We'll come back to this. Because, you know, eventually it will happen, especially if he's a long-term investor. And when it happens, it's much easier to deal with. And I was very glad that I did that from, you know, the very beginning, because it really saved me a lot of time and headaches, you know, through 17 and 18, you know, in terms of potential anger from investors. Now, it's true that, you know, the Irma creep was suffered by anyone. And of course, you have to size the side pockets and you have different views on, you know, whether it's better to be over conservative or less conservative and so on. But as soon as you create a side pocket, then investors do appreciate that it's probably better to isolate that type of volatility and avoid any surprise that could be either way in their advantage as an existing investor or in their disadvantage, you know, versus new investors coming in. You know, how you You know, I remember when we created this first side pocket back in 2011, you know, investors were saying, well, rather than creating a side pocket, you should really take a big hit to the NAV so that we can come in at a lower level of NAV and say, well, but that's not the spirit of this asset class, you know, it's a difficult to value position. So we can't really, you know, just put a number there. And also because if you come in at the lower NAV, then you are going to dilute our existing investors, which are our partners, are the guys that actually allowed us to start. You know, it was 3 years after we started. It was for Tohoku and, you know, at the time. So definitely, Steve, I mean, the more we can talk, and that's why, you know, sometimes, obviously, when you talk on the screen, when you have this WebEx, it's great in terms of the communication. But sometimes when you have the face-to-face meeting, you also can see whether they actually write it down rather than just listening. So it really helps to say, okay, are you actually writing down what I'm saying about side pockets and collateral trapping so that we can then go and do a deep dive on that or not? you know, those are the sort of things I think that you know, we should always talk about.
Sure. Thanks, Lorenzo. So, Donna, moving to you as the consultant in the room, in your discussions with investors, are they really concerned about loss creep? Is it something they understand, and do they understand the potential for it to happen and the potential impacts it can have as well?
I actually want to, it's a good question, and it's definitely something that comes up, and I wanted to reiterate a point that Lorenzo made. I think everyone's kind of, when they learn about the asset class, they take the note on it, but it's almost, it doesn't really sink in or kick in because it is quite a unique concept to this asset class. And so I think there's been a little bit of an unfortunate education by experience, and it almost, that's how the investor gets to learn what this, you know, loss creep and side pocketing actually looks like. And I think especially in 2017, because you had a bulk of some of those actual claims come in really late in 2020. And so it was the concept of, it was almost out of sight, out of mind. Investors thought, you know, that event had been dealt with, and, you know, all the media had moved on. But then, you know, suddenly all these losses are actually popping up again. And so it's, as Lorenzo and Martin both talked to, it's that communication. So you've valued the loss, you've estimated what it's going to be. But as that loss crystallizes through into the portfolio, it's that communication. So it's not that surprise because, you know, as you've mentioned, in a lot of other asset classes, the loss happens, you take the hit, you move on. But it's, yeah, it's a little bit of that delayed reaction here and understanding actually fundamentally what does that mean for my return, and then understanding actually how was that treated from the fund's perspective, and then how as an investor do I have to look at that. I think how that's communicated and dealt with is really important, and we're definitely seeing, I think it's made people a little bit hesitant because they have witnessed that loss creep from 17 and 18 and it was so substantial. So it's getting them comfortable with physically this is what it's going to mean in practice. And I agree, Lauren, so get them to write it down on paper, but it's almost, all right, physically what's this going to mean for my capital? Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and I think maybe the asset class originally, again, going back over a decade or more, used to talk about the short tail nature of cat risk, and maybe some investors came into the asset class feeling everything was going to be short tailed in terms of development, but actually it hasn't turned out that way. I mean, even the Japanese quake earlier this year has now been creeping steadily and continues to rise on the industry loss from it. And Donna, the side pockets themselves. Oh, sorry, go on, Lorenzo.
Sorry, Steve, another actually point, which I think is very interesting, is obviously the side pocket creates illiquidity, right? Mm-hmm. But sometimes investors need to ask themselves, is it better for us to take a very conservative approach and crystallize a loss, or fight until the very last minute to pay them back, you know, even if it's one penny? So I think that's, you know, always a good way of explaining to investors, you know, we work for you and it's in our interest to collect back as much as we can. So during the uncertainty, we create some illiquidity, but it's better than just write that off and forget about it. And apologies for the corruption.
No, that's another very good point, Lorenzo. And obviously the whole commutation process in insurance is something that investors may not understand very well too. And it's obviously in their favor that process exists and that it does take time in some cases. Donna, just moving back to you again on the side pockets, it's something that some institutional investors may be familiar with from the hedge fund world. But do you feel do your investors who you speak to, do they believe they're getting the transparency they want? Are they asking for more transparency? Sort of how are they thinking about this at the moment?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think there's probably two challenges for investors in terms of side pocketing and the concept of what they're seeing as it plays out. I think the first one is that concept of conflict of interest, for want of a better word. You've got a lot of stakeholders involved within the asset class. You've got fiduciaries, you've got a lot of intermediaries. And so it's understanding, yes, generally I have to trust that they are acting in my best interest, but sometimes when that means that person's holding back your capital, it's difficult to actually trust and believe in that is what the manager is doing on your behalf. So I think it's that conflict of interest, and is the incentive there to really push to commute and to get the best outcomes, especially, you know, you've got some discussions on, do you pay fees on this trapped collateral and what happens in terms of what I'm paying for it and how that cash is being used. And then I think the second thing is to that point of actually, how is that cash being used? Is it being treated as cash? Is it being treated as risk on? Is it something in between? And so it's understanding, what does that trapped collateral look like from an investment perspective? And so how do I need to consider it? And so Martin and Lorenzo touched on it earlier. Any kind of structure that can be put in place to release or to free up some of that capital and keep that investment as liquid as possible, I think that really aids the investor perspective. And I think it helps them to understand it again in terms of other asset classes, because there's definitely some unique quirks to the asset class, which are fantastic and work in the investor's favour. But some of the more unique factors like this, I think you're right, you need that transparency, you need that understanding and that communication that, yes, we're definitely doing this for your benefit. And I think, again, it comes back, you mentioned the short tail versus the long tail. It is still a short tail risk, but in a world where everything seems to be speeding up, the rate of information transfer is speeding up, sometimes that short term can still feel quite long when you're just watching it continue to develop. So, yeah, I would reiterate that communication and those multiple solutions, if you can add leverage, if you can kind of reuse some of that capital, is really important.
Yeah, thank you, Donna. That's helpful. So we're going to move on, and Lorenzo, I'm going to ask you, at Leadenhall, you work obviously with your core partner, MS Amlin, but you've also backed another rated reinsurance vehicle now, Nectaris Re. Is this making it easier for you to manage potential exposure to events, trapped collateral, those sorts of issues, do you think, going forwards?
Definitely the case. I think actually, you know, the relationship with Mitsui Sumitomo Amlin has really helped since the beginning. I mean, you know, the vision at the time was, you know, to have a JV with a balance sheet, basically, with a strong reinsurance company that insurance or insurance company with access to their balance sheet. You know, we've always thought, given our, you know, background on the origination and structuring, that side pockets and collateral trapping would have always been the gray area in this industry, if we can say so. And mitigation, I mean, we actually don't really suffer collateral trapping, thanks for that. I mean, that's why maybe it's also easier for me to bring up the problem at the beginning of the conversation to then discuss how we tackle it. Yes, all those, I mean, to Donna's points, you know, any type of solution to allow investors to come closer and closer to the model that is used by traditional reinsurers is obviously very welcome. And that's where we spent a lot of time, you know, thinking through on the structuring side. And by backing Nectaris Re, we have an additional vehicle, of course, and also the ability to give back the tail, you know, at a decent, without spending too much money, which has been always a big, a big of a headache, to our partner company, is also very advantageous to investors, and allows us, to achieve exactly what we've been discussed this morning. So definitely.
Yeah. No, these are steps that are helping to make the industry a bit more predictable for investors as well, I suppose. Martin, at Mount Logan Re, you're structured a little differently, but how are you managing issues related to side pockets and trapped collateral, and how do you help your investors understand when this does occur?
Yeah, sure. And similar to some of Lorenzo's comments in terms of, you know, Mount Logan Re, we're aligned with Everest Re. This is one area I think the aligned platforms may have somewhat of a competitive advantage. So for our separately managed accounts, you know, we've never trapped any capital since inception. That capital came in 14, 15, and we've been able to roll it, and any uncertainty kind of is just rolled. So it's been 100% on NAV as we think about it, underwriting at each renewal date. In regards to, we have had side pockets. Well, we've never had more than 5% of AUM side pocketed, and that was related to our co-mingled accounts. And it's a much lower number. And I echo Donna and Lorenzo's comments. It's about communication and education. And it's about having, you know, again, a robust process around your loss reserving. And maybe one of the benefits when you have, you know, decades of experience is, you know, the more robust your process, not only is the better your original estimate, but you can have tighter ranges around, you know, what's your high, low estimate around the recent losses. So, you know, if it's Texas recently, you know, people should be expecting inflation with the pandemic, you know, supplies. Even if it was Irma, you know, people, you know, the Florida legal system was there before Irma impacted other legal Florida hurricanes. So while it still did creep for the industry, you know, if you have experience with the each individual cedent, you can experience, you know, rating them over several decades. And I think that helps. And I think it's really communicating your process to investors. So when we think about side pockets in our co-mingled account, it's really not a negative process. It's talking to your investors when they come in co-mingled series. You'll have investors coming in at fair times. And all our, you know, all the side pocket process is really trying to do is to ensure a fair allocation of returns amongst investors who come into a co-mingled strategy. So our goal is always to, you know, side pocket the least amount of capital we can to ensure that fair allocation amongst investors coming in at different times into a co-mingled product. And then once you side pocket it, continue to look at the reserves frequently and release the capital as soon as we can. So either the investor who's left can get their money back, or the investors that are still in can put that money to work. So I think it's about having that kind of robust, you know, you should have your robust side pocket policy, communicated absolutely like Lorenzo said earlier, to investors before they invest. And then, you know, ongoing communication about how you do it and discussing with them, you know, you really are aligned. Like our investors, we actually call them like our capital partners. And, you know, this is something that, you know, our investors who are side pocketed, they also want to have the side pocket there. If they think the loss estimates come down and you've done a good job, they'll get the benefit. Are the new ones coming in aren't exposed to it. And I'd probably finish with saying, you know, the last couple of years now you have a track record. So you can look at your 2017, 18, 19, 20 side pockets and how did you do your estimates? How much did you have to side pocket? And how quickly have you been able to release it? So at least we have a track record. So it's not really just a policy now. You can actually show investors and say, here's how we've managed that process in our co-mingled vehicle. So before they invest, they can look at that. And that's very helpful. And then for some of our single separately managed accounts, they've actually asked us, you know, kind of, can you run that what if scenario if we hadn't been separately managed and had to side pocket? You know, what would that have meant if we side pocketed 10% of capital, as an example, in 2017? And they can kind of like work out what was that return benefit to them for being in a kind of a separately managed vehicle. And they, you know, again, to help them with their own internal communications.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Martin. So we actually have a question from the audience that's very relevant, so I think I'm going to come to it now. Just somebody asking, so no, they're not aware of managers who might have prepared investors that it could take up to 4 years for side pockets to be paid out, and there's still side pockets from 2017 events, which they believe is beyond what investors had really expected. What can the industry do to avoid such situations going forwards? Now, I guess communication up front is one of them. But have you got any other thoughts, Lorenzo, perhaps?
Well, you know, obviously there is a difference between if the investor is worried about the liquidity of the side pocket, which is illiquid, that's one thing. If he's worried about the drag on the potential return, then you know, we can give them comfort that the side pocket doesn't cause a drag in our case, because we are able, as Martin said as well, I think in their case, to roll over the capital anyway. So, but otherwise, I think it's difficult because you know, ultimately we deal with traditional insurance companies. Traditional insurance companies have no incentive to basically commute a loss until they have a certainty that they're actually loss-free. So I don't see how, you know, we can use structuring features like, you know, like Taris Re or the balance sheet of Mitsui Sumitomo Hamlin, but otherwise we can see how we could, you know, eliminate that risk. I mean, obviously, there is a negotiation factor as well. Every time you go to the renewal, you negotiate also on the basis of what you've been told with respect to reserves associated to past events. And that can help as well, either to get a higher level of premium in case they still want, they still think that the reserves are correct and they're not coming down, or to release, you know, some of the collateral in case they think, okay, maybe we are overly conservative, you have a point, so maybe you don't need to overcharge us at the renewal, and we release a bit of the collateral back. But to provide an exact timeline of commutation, I think is going to be hard. I mean, it's also true, to that question, it's also true that, you know, when we started in 2008, I remember that the consensus was more about, you know, 3 years of tail risk to 4 years for earthquakes, and probably 2 to 3 years for hurricanes. And the reason was, well, for an earthquake, you don't see a lot of things that go underneath the earth. And we saw, you know, Tohoku was a classic example, you know, that the actual composition of the land changed following the event. And sadly, everyone realized that the cost to rebuild on site would have been much higher because the land was harder to work with. You know, they went into the stadium after like 3 or 6 months and they realized that all the pipes were broken. So, you know, the earthquakes theoretically should take longer. And the consensus was, well, with hurricanes, even if there are always some unknown unknowns, like Katrina teached us, or tsunamis teached us, but in the terms of hurricanes, you know, we see it coming, you should be able to see, you know, what the actual losses are. And that was the idea at the time. Now, of course, we learn the hard way with Irma because of loss adjustment expenses and assignment of benefits, given the local legal system in Florida, which is quite unique, by the way. It was not the same across different states in the U.S. So I don't think we can basically say, oh, you know, we're going to be sure that within 4 years, you know, this is going to be over for going forward. But there are structuring mechanisms that allow you to make your money work efficiently anyway, irrespective of those events. The liquidity aspect, obviously, is the question mark. But, you know, yeah. 90% plus of our money comes from pension funds, and usually they're not really worried about liquidity. It's more the high net worths and the wealth money managers that get worried about, you know, the liquidity of the side pockets.
Sure, sure. Donna, just a quick question for you related to that. Do your clients, the end investors, do they understand the potential tail in ILS?
I think on paper, it's like a lot of things in terms of the terms and conditions within a contract. On paper, they do, but I think it's also feeling like as the end investor that the manager's sharing my pain. And so I definitely reiterate the point about communication and needing to understand, and not just understanding what's happening, but understanding the why behind it. So to Lorenzo's point, actually, why is it taking this long? So explaining the why, making sure that's not a surprise, but then is there any way that you can kind of explain the challenges you're feeling, I think, from that trapped collateral as well? I mean, it's hampering how you can reinvest for the portfolio. And I think it's always going to come up, but if there's any way that you can share the fee burden on that as well. So is there some way that, you know, this is capital they can't invest anywhere else, and so is there some fee relief that you can provide somewhere else that you can feel like they're not just kind of stuck in this trapped collateral situation on their own? So, yeah, anything you can make them feel that they're not just out there on their own with, you know, capital that's dried up and they can't do anything with, I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, thank you, Donna. Martin.
No, I would just add, you know, I mean, one, for some of the aligned platforms, since we actually source the insurance risk, you know, we're taking that kind of one piece of the chain out. And that has allowed us for certain single investor accounts in the past to actually solve that question that the audience had in terms of we can pre-agree at the investment that if you do exit, you will exit fully based on this collateral table, you know, subject to some risk margin, you know, as determined by the outside auditor. So while it's not a process in our co-mingled accounts, we also have to ensure a fair allocation of returns amongst individual investors on single investor accounts. That's something we can pre-agree and to, you know, to give a definite kind of final transaction date to that investor.
Okay, that's an interesting option.
Well, yeah, one question I have, Martin, though, is whether it comes at the cost, right? Because obviously you can pre-agree, but then at the end of the day, if there is still a chance for tail development, then someone is going to take some cost, right?
Yeah, I think really what we've done is it's like the old buffer loss tables, but it's just agreeing to it and then agreeing with your auditors, you know, so you got that independence and it automatically commutes. I think what we've been comfortable at Everstreet, because, you know, it's such a large balance sheet, so these transactions, you know, are relatively small. So, to your point, Lorenzo, over time, if you did a lot of these deals, there might be little bits of ups and downs. But really, when these events get out into the tail, you know, there's generally, you know, after 3 years, there shouldn't be much in terms of material change. I mean, even when we look at Hurricane Irma, you know, if you side bucket a 10% of capital for Hurricane Irma, you know, in January 1, 2018, how much of that capital is still side pocketed, you know, today? You know, the numbers are, you know, relatively small. And it's really just a, you know, between two parties having judgment on how it works. Yeah.
Yeah, we've also looked at, you know, doing some trading of in the secondary market for side pockets, which, you know, obviously was done independently without our advice, but obviously comes at the cost as well. But sometimes you have the high net worth individuals that really want to just get some of their money back. So, you know, that also worked, which I think it was a nice development as well in the market.
Which may be something that will develop further. Sorry, Donna, go on.
I was just going to say, I think the COVID business interruption will be an interesting issue in terms of this concept as well, with how long is it going to take for these losses to kind of develop and crystallise. And so I think some of those suggestions from Martin and Lorenzo could be really useful with that as a case study.
Yes, that's a good point, Donna, because that's something that everybody's still waiting on, it seems, at the moment, and there doesn't seem to be much clarity still, although I believe a lot is getting commuted, and we'll just have to see when that actually, if it comes back to rear its head. So we're running a little low on time now, so just remind our audience, if they want to put in any questions, please do so soon. But I wanted to move on, and as this is an event focused on the Asia region, while we've tried to provide some sort of education around some of the investment management issues being seen today, I wanted to ask you sort of about the Asian region and the investor base there and how you're seeing it. So sadly, we can't be there again this year. But Lorenzo, perhaps beginning with you, how have investor discussions changed with those based in Asia over the last year or so? And are you finding any increase in awareness and appetite there?
Well, there's definitely increasing of awareness because we have a, you know, strong partner locally with a strong team, you know, Mitsui Sumitomo. And, you know, they're doing a lot of work locally to keep discussing about, you know, what happened in the past, what the opportunities are in the future. So I've been lucky enough to have a number of, you know, WebEx calls with investors, and we are building strong relationships there, which we're very pleased about how Japan is developing. Obviously, you know, Japan, there are mixed experiences in terms of non-life. They've been invested in non-life ILS for quite a long time, and obviously different managers, different results. And again, we're hoping that by continuing to engage with them and provide as much transparency as possible, we will get closer also to new investors and to convince them again that actually it is still worth maintaining or adding an allocation to non-life ILS. On the life side, you know, it's going well. There's always been demand in Japan, So definitely strong. Again, I think the investors' interest in Japan, or at least you know, they're all monitoring the asset class. They have other regions where if historically the penetration has not been high. You have some big elephants, but they always connect twice a year just to do a review of the opportunity set, and then postpone it. I think the lack of traveling doesn't help as well. I think it would be easier if we could meet face to face. Obviously in Australia, Donna is better positioned than me to comment, but there is they know the asset class, and you have some interest from time to time, but probably not as much as it used to be in the past.
That's interesting, Lorenzo. I was actually going to ask you, Donna, I know you're largely focused on Australian institutional investors there, but how is appetite in Australia at the moment among the super funds and the pensions? Is it recovering after recent loss years, or is it still slightly depressed?
There's definitely a couple of headwinds in the market. I mean, we've had some legislation changes, which we won't touch on today because you could have a whole other conference almost on some of those headwinds. But I think we're seeing almost two sides of the coin in terms of appetite. So there's been some really good, strong appetite from new investors. I think the challenge we've found is existing investors are feeling a little bit bruised and battered by the recent loss years and some of those issues that we've talked about. And I think for new investors, to Lorenzo's point, it is difficult, like you said, if you can't kind of meet face-to-face and really talk through the industry. But I think also there's been, a lot of layers and a lot of talk in the industry about things like climate change, about modelling risk, about intermediaries, all of those different concepts that make it feel, maybe it's a bit more opaque, maybe it's not quite as transparent, it's a little bit harder to understand that end concept. I think, the proposition of it as an asset class, cash plus four or even more uncorrelated, it's still a fantastic proposition. But I almost liken the attitude here to, you have a lot of people who are very, very terrified of flying, but they're very, very comfortable to drive in a car. But if you look at the statistical impacts of that, it's a lot safer to fly than it is to drive in a car. But when you're in a car, it feels like it's, as an individual, you're more in control of that risk, and it's a little bit better understood. And I think it's almost that's almost the attitude towards ILS. It's not quite as well understood, so maybe it feels riskier for the investor, and so it's getting them comfortable and understanding what those true risks are. Yeah,
maybe an area that in Australia maybe is becoming even more interesting for investors is the CAD bond. It seems like for some of the local investors, a safer and easier entry. I mean, if I think about new investors, we just launched an US and Australian dollar share class in our carbon fund because we have a new investor that came in, which I never met in person, but through a number of WebEx, we managed to connect and discuss about it. So, but to Donna's point, I think the face-to-face probably would help.
And I think that's a great point, Lorenzo. The other thing we're seeing with cat bonds is almost a move away from looking for a diversified portfolio, almost back to those peak perils, the feeling like maybe the modelling's a little bit safer there, it's a little bit more accurate, the climate information is a little bit safer there. So it's almost, if my portfolio is diversified elsewhere, maybe I just want to target US wind risk or some of the more well-known perils. So it's interesting to see that change in appetite.
Mm. It's also interesting because potentially choice in the market is actually a little lower now for those sort of peak peril strategies as well, given the size of some of the big cat bond funds. Yeah. It's an opportunity for managers to develop new strategies, I suppose, to meet that demand. Martin, turning to you, what are some of the sort of important considerations Mount Logan Re takes into account when you're discussing ILS with potential allocators in the Asia region?
Yeah, we have some investors from a couple of countries in Asia. I think in general, just to, and this probably goes beyond just investors from the Asia region, but just to really listen to the investor needs and, what are they looking to get out of their investment in ILS. So we always try to be flexible in our approach. We've had some investors from the Asian region, as an example, Lorenzo mentioned Japan, where we'll build a worldwide diversified portfolio, excluding Japan. We've done another one actually excluding Australia for an Australian investor. And I think if you build how we think about it, it could be portfolio construction, it could be liquidity, it could be reporting, different terms that meet their needs. And I think, you know, with that kind of partnership approach, especially with the investors who are very thoughtful and methodical, some of the investors we've worked with come from the Asian region, you can then build that kind of long-term partnership. You know, and several of our investors who kind of invested in 2013 when we launched, one or two of our other big investors in 2014 are still with us today. And they've kind of increased and reduced their holdings kind of throughout the cycle. But, you know, it's great to see them, that they've been with us for the full 8 years. I think if you build a partnership the right way and you solve your investor needs, what do they need for their portfolio? And you create that kind of win-win. You know, hopefully you can build a solution that can, you know, last several decades. Because it really is kind of partnership capital, you know, in terms of how we think about supporting our franchise.
Mm. Yeah, no, thank you, Martin. So I think now we'll just move and take a couple of questions from the audience. And if anybody has got any last questions, please do submit them now. We've got a question about sort of ILS domiciles. And obviously, we've now got Singapore, which has been having a lot of activity. And we hope Hong Kong is going to come on stream too as well. But somebody's asked, why do you think Singapore seems to be attracting more traction than perhaps we've seen in some of the European markets, like, I guess, London and also Paris is the other one? Is it the more attractive regime? Is it anything to do with tax privileges? Is it anything to do with investors' locations? Or, I guess, is it just the grant scheme? Who would like to take that? Lorenzo, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it's probably cost and location. If you are, you know, in, obviously there is a strong push to diversify domiciles and in the hope that that will attract more sponsors to the market. Now, I'm not sure how easy it's been in that part of the world to have face-to-face meetings. So, you know, now with technology, when you are also structuring an issuance or a bond, you probably just have a WebEx anyway. Now again, I'm not on the structuring side. I haven't been structuring car bonds since I joined Leadenhall, you know, 15 years ago. But I assume it's, you know, more about cost. I mean, that would be my... Those were the sensitivities when I was structuring the bonds, but maybe today is different, maybe.
Yes, so Martin, we have an office in Singapore. I think, you know, Singapore is doing a good job. They have a, you know, a business-friendly regulator, you know, somewhat similar to Bermuda, where they're, you know, they're really looking to accommodate the market and look to problem solve. And you do see that in some of the jurisdictions, you know, as compared to some of the larger domiciles as well. And, there is a very sophisticated community out there as well. I think that's helped. You have a lot of reinsurance offices in Singapore. So you do have that expertise, you know, locally based in the market as well.
Mm. And actually, we can cover off another question from the audience with a similar topic. Do you as managers, and this will be for Lorenzo and Martin, do you have preference in terms of domicile, in terms of where a structure comes from? Are you worried about investing in anything in Paris or in Singapore or London, or is it, are you agnostic as to the actual sort of source of the transaction?
Sure. I mean, I think from our perspective, you know, Everest, we have offices around the world, so we have cedents from more than 100 countries. So probably the short answer is no, you know, outside of any kind of OFAC or other requirements where, you know, as a reinsurance entity, we won't transact. We're not too concerned in terms of where we source risk. And then we're just very thoughtful about the investor needs. You know, if investors we have found from different jurisdictions, you know, have different kind of needs or wants, and just, you know, clear communication and looking to try to build the product the right way to kind of create that win-win for both parties, which hopefully will lead to a kind of a long-term partnership.
Sure. Thank you, Martin. Lorenzo, anything?
It's the same for us, Steve. I mean, our partner, Mitsui Sumitomo and Amrin, they have offices around the world. I mean, we are agnostic, really. It's all about sourcing.
Sure, sure. And finally, Donna, I mean, when you discuss the asset class with investors, do they express any, or do they ask any questions about the different domiciles or perhaps about different structures? I mean, do you get investors who say, well, we'd love to just invest in parametric risk, for example?
Yeah, so it depends on the purpose within the portfolio and some of the restrictions around how their existing portfolio needs to be constructed. And so, you know, sometimes there is issues with domiciles or the way that risk is written. But I think it also is a lot about do they need a fiduciary or some of those structures as well. We are seeing more interest in terms of parametric risk. To our points earlier, sometimes it's easier to understand how that loss develops in the portfolio and when an event has occurred, is that going to hit a contract? And so sometimes that can be better. But yeah, to Martin's point that he made earlier, I think it's such an individual conversation. And I think it's also why the industry is so hard to benchmark, because almost every single portfolio that's created is unique and has its own unique structures. And so it makes it challenging to compare and, you kind of just have to look at the individual investor's experience.
Sure. Yeah. Which is also positive, though, because it does leave a lot of choice for investors, too, in terms of looking at one manager versus another, or even strategies a single manager can offer them as well. So look, we've run slightly over time. So I'd just like to say a big thank you to Lorenzo, Martin and Donna. Thank you for sharing your time and your expertise with us today. For the audience, thank you for logging in. Do remember you'll be able to watch the full thing on demand if you came in halfway through, and everything else will be available after the initial broadcast for you to view as well. And we'll be back on Monday with two sessions in the morning and around the middle of the day as well. So thank you for all for watching.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Hey, thanks, Steve.